Hey everyone, it's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for up to half the cost. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Savings based on cost of Consumer Cellular single line 1, 5, and 10 gig data plans with unlimited talk and text compared to lowest cost single line postpaid unlimited talk, text, and data plans offered by T-Mobile and Verizon January 2024.
Everyone, I'm Chuck Todd, and this is a special edition of Meet the Press. On today's show, we're going to bring you one of our recent episodes from Meet the Press Reports, plus a related interview that I conducted on the Chuck Toddcast. If you like what you hear, you can subscribe to the Chuck Toddcast wherever you get your podcasts, so do that now. We hope you enjoy. Hello there, I'm Chuck Todd, and welcome to our second season of Meet the Press Reports, where we take a deep dive into a single issue for the entire half hour. Today, this is the first of three episodes that are going to be focused on key security threats to this country. On this episode, we're looking at violent political extremism. Over the past two decades, the vast majority of political violence in this country has come from far-right extremists. In fact, more than five times the rate of violence from people on the far left. Far right-wing attacks account for the majority of all terror-related incidents in this country since 1994. That, according to the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Now, the Department of Homeland Security has been warning that white supremacist extremists will remain the most persistent and lethal threat to our country. And January 6th was not the first time we saw a federal building violently attacked with deadly consequences. From the Oklahoma City bombing in 1995, to the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville in 2017, to the pipe bomber threats in 2018, to the kidnapping threats against Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer and Virginia Governor Ralph Northam in 2020, and finally that horrific attack on the Capitol in the final days of the Trump presidency. It is clear that violent domestic extremism has stepped out of America's shadows and into our political spotlight. NBC News correspondent Morgan Radford and producer Aaron Franco have been reporting on this issue for years, covering white nationalist candidates running for office to hate groups like the KKK, as well as new extremists on the far left. And you're about to see Morgan's deeper look at what's behind all of it. A bit of a warning here. Some of the video and language may be quite disturbing to some viewers.
You will not replace us!
The images have become all too familiar. A burst of violence, then fear.
I'm running into harm's way. That's why I have my rifle.
And then, chaos.
At least 18 people have been killed.
It's a formula for terror. Public attacks we see, and many we don't.
Preparing to kidnap and possibly kill me.
More than 200 attacks and plots in the past 6 years, spread out over 42 states.
The number of plots and attacks are at the highest level we've ever seen.
I don't know whether we've seen the worst of it. We sure have not seen the last of it.
And while many were from far left and jihadist groups, the vast majority were committed by the far right, nearly 60%, a percentage that surged even higher in the last 6 years.
Right-wing extremism has entered a frightening new phase in this country.
The FBI now calling lone wolf attacks from violent extremists the nation's greatest threat. But are they isolated incidents or part of a bigger trend? To find out, we traveled the country, speaking with experts, militia members, former members of extremist groups, and those who still have ties to them. And one thing became clear. The idea that the Capitol attack was not just possible, but predictable.
Did you know anyone who was there at the January 6th riot?
Yes. I was at parties with these people. I interviewed one of these people into his first hate group.
Samantha knows the face of far-right extremism better than most.
So we're in South Carolina. Is this where you were radicalized?
Mm-hmm. She knows because that face was her own.
I did not think I was racist. I thought that I saw a truth that no one else did.
Were you racist?
Absolutely.
Samantha asks that her last name not be used to protect her safety. She was inducted into a white supremacist group called Identity Europa nearly 4 years ago after her boyfriend had been radicalized online.
He had started saying some just strange things that I now know are all far-right jokes and slogans. But I confronted him and just point blank was like, what is this? What are all these phrases? And he had said that he was a fascist and he didn't want to be with someone that didn't support that. I was so desperate for his approval that I ended up choosing to try and understand it. And I fell into the far right.
There, she met some of the most prominent faces of the modern far right, including Richard Spencer and the organizers of the Charlottesville Unite the Right rally.
This is the type of awful tool, propaganda tool.
They would get books written by or about Jewish people and burn them. And the whole concept behind it was to stop anyone else from having to read Jewish propaganda. But yeah, it was a book burning.
Before splitting apart in 2019, Identity Europa was one of the most active groups in the far right. Their goal? To be mainstream, avoiding recognizable racist images, and instead using ambiguous talking points about white identity.
So once you're inside, and once you enter this movement, what were the views of the people around you? Did they believe that immigration was okay?
No.
Did they believe that black people were as intelligent as white people?
Absolutely not.
Did they believe in the Holocaust?
You're kind of softballed on all of these topics. And by the end, if all of these things work correctly, then absolutely no immigration. Like, the race IQ theory is real. Holocaust absolutely never happened. But Hitler was just a compassionate and empathetic person who just wanted to take care of his people.
Wow.
Dylann Roof, the mass murderer, was a saint. Segregation is an absolute ideal.
I think what's so shocking about this movement in today's day and age is here you are, you know, have your wits about you. How do you end up in this space?
I think part of the reason I decided to speak up was because there are so many high-ranking people in this movement. No one wore hoods. They wore slacks. They were EMTs. They were lawyers. They were doctors. They were your neighbors. They were your family members, still believing in all of this stuff. And I think that is what makes all of this so dangerous and so, it's just terrifying. You can't spot the white nationalist anymore.
When Heather Heyer was killed by a white supremacist in Charlottesville, Samantha began to have doubts. 2 months later, her grandmother died, a woman born in Germany and forced to be a member of the Hitler Youth as a child.
How did she feel about you joining the violent alt-right?
She knew exactly what it was as soon as I presented it to her. She called me out and just said, you know, that is Nazism. What you think you're doing is Nazism.
Now, Samantha uses her experience to help others through a project called Future Freedom, an online platform for those on the inside who want to get out.
This is a problem that I think is reaching every living room of every house, every laptop of every computer in the country. And I don't want there to be a world where there are X amount more of me's that went through it and have no idea how they fell for that. No one needs this trauma.
It's a trauma that only appears to be spreading. Extremism experts at the Anti-Defamation League say white supremacist propaganda is now at the highest level ever recorded. And it's reaching people in new ways. One recent study found that between 2005 and 2010, just under 27% of lone wolf extremists were radicalized online in some way. By 2016, that number was more than 73%.
What has changed in the last 20 years is that it has broadened its appeal by, in a sense, reinventing itself around more polite, seemingly innocuous language. What you will see are things like white pride, celebrating European heritage. But if you dig into it, it's the same old racist ideology. It's just been repackaged.
A transformation that sometimes takes a winding road. Chester Doles is running for a county commissioner seat in Lumpkin County, Georgia, about an hour north of Atlanta. He's also fundraising in support of candidates he believes share his values.
I'm running on a MAGA candidate platform. There's a tidal wave of MAGA candidates that are going to rise up in 2022.
What are your top three issues?
My top three issues would be pro-life, pro-gun, pro-wall.
When he was younger, he was a leader in the Ku Klux Klan and a member of a neo-Nazi group.
Stand back, stand by.
Now, he says that's all in the past. When did you come out and renounce racism? Because I know you did that in the past.
2019, several times in 2020. But whatever banner I might have been fighting under, the enemy had always been the same. Left-wing radicals, you know, socialist.
But the Ku Klux Klan isn't against leftist radicals. They're against Black people, Jews. What do you believe now that you didn't believe then?
Like I said, it just depends on who's looking at it. When I've ever read anything like that, it seemed like they were just pro-heritage.
The Ku Klux Klan?
But, well, in some forms. But I'm not here to defend them. It was 28 years ago, and I will not spend one more day from... I did this last year. No more apologies. Get over it.
Publicly disavowed by candidates at the federal level, including Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene and former Senator Kelly Loeffler. He's since thrown his support behind a new slate of candidates, some of them from diverse backgrounds. But many still question whether Doles has changed at all.
I know that you had come out and denounced racism, but when I was looking at social media, you had put this picture here saying that Jovi Vow was coming to speak at one of your rallies here. And then this is him, Jovi Vow, with a racist. And I mean, this is a Nazi hand gesture. And then he posted here, "Get in, we're hunting Juden." So he's talking about Jews. And that's him at your platform. Do you think that's someone who's a white supremacist?
You know, I wouldn't call him a white supremacist. I think Jovi's got some issues. I didn't know he was quite that extreme.
You invited him. When you invited him and said you were bringing him here, he had already posted those things.
Yeah, well, Jovi was vibed a lot with the MAGA. I wasn't aware of any of his other street activism.
But what about... like on your social media, these are the people following you with swastikas and white power signs. Why are these people attracted to you and your platform?
I don't know. Maybe they're good people, you know, as far as being good American citizens and stuff. But
can you be a good person, a good American citizen with a swastika and white power?
I don't look into people's personal, you know, what they're all about.
What about this one? I saw you posted just recently this year. You were posting about Valentine's Day stickers and you showed 1488.
Oh, God forbid.
What does that mean?
I don't know.
You don't know what 1488 means?
No.
All that time and in the Klan and reading these white supremacists, 1488 means nothing to
you?
I
couldn't tell you.
Is it a coincidence that it's a white supremacist?
It must be.
He knows exactly what it means.
Jonathan Greenblatt is an extremism expert with the Anti-Defamation League.
The number 14 refers to what they describe as the 14 words, which is kind of a white supremacist maxim. And 88 refers to the letter H, right? It's the eighth letter of the alphabet, and HH means Heil Hitler.
Doles is no longer a member of the Klan, so is it fair to still label him a white supremacist or an extremist?
ADL's been tracking Doles and other white supremacists for years, and this is something that they do, Morgan. So white supremacists often use this ethos of, quote, plausible deniability. With a wink and a nod, will signal to white supremacists, but look at, let's say, the mainstream media and say, but I'm not one of them anymore.
It's a denial and a movement that leads some to take matters into their own hands. This is the NFAC. An all-Black militia with a mission to defend the Black community by any means necessary.
So this is training for one of the new chapters.
Yes.
Appearing by the hundreds at protests from Stone Mountain, Georgia to Louisville, Kentucky, they demand justice for police killings of unarmed Black citizens and counter what they believe is the threat of right-wing militias. It's a movement started in 2017 by this man, former musician and Army veteran John Grandmaster Jay Johnson.
Is the movement growing?
By leaps and bounds.
We met with him outside of Cincinnati, where he says another new chapter is now in the works.
The NFAC stands for the Not Effing Around Coalition.
What's behind the name?
The NFAC was born out of the last 4 years under the Trump administration. The deterioration of racial relations in this country, it means that you're preparing yourself to defend yourselves by any means necessary.
Is violence an option to reach your goals?
The United States was built on violence being an option. Violence should be the last option.
Extremism experts say the group is distinct from far-right militias, with a record of coordinating with police and avoiding violence.
When you talk about January 6th, and we saw those rioters storm the Capitol, What do you say to critics who say, you're no different from them? They're extremists, you're extremists.
Show me where we have done those things. They've killed people. They've disrespected the government to the point where they have invaded its sacred halls. Show me where we've done those things, because we have done none of them.
We were allowed rare access to a training site of a chapter at a secret location in rural Georgia.
We are now driving to the NFAC training facility.
We spoke to one member who only gave us a code name, Shy, to protect her anonymity.
Why did you decide to join this movement?
It's for the cause. Black people, we need to learn how to defend them. This is definitely one way to do it.
Do you all, I mean, have normal jobs? You work in all different sectors?
And absolutely. We're business owners. We're doctors, lawyers. We're your everyday person. Anywhere from Walmart to the corporate sector.
What are you all training for?
We're training for self-defense.
We have all these different groups, those who are far-right extremists, those who are combating the far-right extremists, and then people who are trying to help de-radicalize young people online. How does this country begin to solve this problem?
There is no silver bullet that will solve the problem of extremism. We actually need not just the full force of government, we need a whole of society strategy if we hope to tackle this.
Tackle a problem that may only be getting worse.
I mean, and some of us will stand to the end, to defending American values and family values. I think the enthusiasm that was so overwhelming on January 6th was because people seen it as our last, this is it. Trump's gone, we're done.
Is that what you think?
Yeah.
What do you think those rioters thought they were doing?
I think they all thought that they were revolutionaries, that they were going to bring justice and the truth out to the country. I know what that feels like. I felt that too.
You thought you were the last stand of
the Western civilization.
A civilization that some are afraid will leave them behind.
And Morgan Radford joins me now, along with former special agent for the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosive, Jim Cavanaugh, who helped investigate and sometimes negotiate with some of the most infamous violent domestic extremists in this country over the span of more than three decades. Morgan, a tremendous piece. In some ways, there's a lot to unpack here, but I just want to start with your first character in your piece, Samantha. Is she going to, you know, when you join this and she's left it, how much of this past of hers is still haunting her?
I think it still haunts her. You heard her say no one deserves this trauma. I mean, she acknowledges that this was an incredibly difficult portion of her life, but that's why she's worked so hard to help de-radicalize people. And one of the things Samantha really taught us is that a lot of these people, Chuck, are attracted to this extremist ideology because it's personal. It gives them a place to feel like they belong. And she speaks very openly about how when these people are going online, they're searching for answers, or ultimately they're searching for connection, they're finding that these far-right, often extremist groups are there with open arms, and that's how they're getting caught.
Morgan, did you get a sense that Samantha, there was a time where she felt good about what she was doing because she had this community?
Absolutely. She's very honest about that. She says that initially, part of what attracted her to this movement was because they told her that she was okay just the way that she was. And she says she liked their approach to femininity, that they said that you can be a traditional woman and hold traditional values and have a traditional role, and that that is okay. Right. So don't pay attention to what society tells you about that not being okay, because we are here to assure you that who you are and what we collectively are doing is right. And so she said that's initially what attracted her. But then, obviously, she came to a point where she said, this is absolutely wrong, because how can I be in this space that says I'm okay, but all of these other groups of people are not?
And Morgan, there was something about Chester Doles that looked awfully familiar to any of us that have followed or reported on white supremacy and all this. He hate to say that, you hate to put it this way, but he kind of looked the part here, and he's not happy with the reporting we've been doing. You've been hearing from him.
And I think one thing to point out, Chuck, is that I honestly don't think that when it comes to this extremist movement, there is such a thing right now as looking the part. Because one of the things understand is that, you know, as Samantha said, that a lot of people, they don't have hoods, right? They have slacks, they have signals and haircuts, and they've made this movement seemingly very innocuous. And that's how it's infiltrated politics, right? From the highest levels. And so with Chester, for example, I mean, what you hear is this belief that people on the far right believe that they are the last stand of Western civilization. He told me very clearly that he felt the 1950s were a more wholesome time, when I pointed out that that wasn't a more wholesome time for my family and people who looked like me. He said, well, you know, that happens. But for him, he felt like it was. And even in anticipation of this interview airing, I have to say, he sent, Chester Dole sent a message, a text message to my producer, Aaron Franco. And he wrote that I was a Marxist reporter. I was a dangerous mouthpiece of the Biden administration, and that, quote, if Trump comes back, she will be remembered. She is definitely the enemy in our eyes. And what you understand from that, Chuck, is anyone who reports on this knows that that is not even a thinly veiled threat. Because what he talked about in our interview was the day of the rope. It is based on this maxim within white supremacist ideology that there will come a day when journalists and politicians and people who are others, people who they don't like, people of color, people who are homosexual, will be hung. They will be executed on the day of the rope. And so he's making a clear connection to the fact that when he believes Trump comes in office, he will have a guy. Right. He will have someone who believes, according to him, in the values that he espouses, and that people like me who bring his feelings to light will be in trouble.
Jim, in your experience, how many Chesters are in this movement and how many Samanthas are in this movement? The reason I say this is, you know, how many people can be rescued like Samantha, and how many people are probably beyond rescuing like Chester?
Well, unfortunately, there's a lot of Chesters who try to hide their white supremacy beliefs and use code words and try to talk around it and be the new alt-right. But there's always a lot of people like Samantha, and you can see the contrast here. Samantha is a person, as Morgan described in this great report, who was radicalized but realized what it was and got out, and truly once got out and renounced it, and now, you know, has a chance for a normal life to become a good citizen. And where Chester is still embracing it, apparently, using 1488, you know, the 14 words from Robert Matthews of the Order, you know, about securing a future for white children, and 88, which is the symbol for Heil Hitler. So that's not renouncing anything. That's still being a member of that belief. And the day of the rope, that's from the Turner Diaries, which is a white supremacist screed written by a National Alliance leader named William Pierce. That was the book that Timothy McVeigh acted upon in his bombing of the Oklahoma City Federal Building, the Turner Diaries. That's a screed that is in white supremacist circles. So he's quoting from, in his communique with Morgan, the Turner Diaries and the Day of the Rope. And that's why they want to hang all their enemies, you know, all their enemies, which they hate, you know, black people, Jewish people, brown people, Catholics, government officials, you know, everybody but them. And, you know, that they deeply held beliefs. So we have a huge problem in America. And it's unbelievable that we've come to it.
I want to get to the issue of we saw the last person there, the gentleman, Grandmaster Jay, that started what he believes is essentially, I guess, an answer to this. But he views it, hey, look, violence, it's a last resort, but it is a resort. Jim, is this just an inevitable response to this right-wing violence?
Well, it's happened before. I mean, we've had clashes with the Communist Party and the Klan. 42 years ago in Greensboro, North Carolina, 1979, Communist Party members were holding a death to the Klan rally, and Klansmen and neo-Nazis arrived. They killed five of the protesters from the Communist Party and wounded another 10 in a big shootout on the street. These are two opposing groups clashing. So, you know, that could certainly come to pass. This NFAC coalition, you know, is like a militia, but they have not been, they have individual members who may have been involved in crimes. I think the leader has some charges pending, but they haven't as a unit committed any grave crimes. But what we've seen across the country is we've loosened these gun laws so much that we have these militiamen in Michigan standing at the Capitol with rifles. We have everybody showing up at demonstrations, you know, slung with their bandoleros and rifles. And eventually you're going to have opposing groups and, you know, you might have the police in the middle. It's a scenario that's really just a recipe for disaster. And eventually, you know, we're going to have to face it.
That's what it feels like. Morgan Radford, terrific reporting. Jim Kavanaugh, as always, your expertise and context in all this is quite important. Really appreciate the time you gave me on our podcast, too. And I encourage folks, listen to our podcast. Jim's got a lot more to say on this. Thank you both. When we come back, democracy is ours, if we can keep it.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Welcome back. This year, we've seen the United States Capitol attacked not once, but twice. And even in a city that's used to lockdowns and national security warnings, this moment in time feels different. Tensions are high and politicians sadly seem eager to join the grievance chorus rather than try to find solutions to our problems. The country is more divided against itself than at any time since the 1960s, and maybe before that. The extremism and violence on the right is only one symptom. Politicians are always telling us there's more that unites us than divides us. That may still be true, but the divisions are easier to see right now. But like most things in history, periods like this are cyclical. And so our democratic experiment in self-governance has weathered tests before. Tests like the one we are in the middle of right now. During the Civil War, our better angels eventually, as Lincoln said, prevailed. After the Gilded Age, our leaders responded to inequity by lifting some of the forgotten out of poverty. During McCarthyism, we pulled ourselves back from the brink. And again, in the Civil Rights era, the federal government stepped in to try to right our collective wrongs. This current test is not yet over. We don't know if we will get a passing grade. This great experiment of democracy is still that, an experiment. And sadly, as we know, many experiments do fail. This patchwork, multiracial, multiethnic, melting pot of a democratic republic is ours for now, if we can keep it. That's all we have time for this episode of Meet the Press Reports. Thank you for watching as we kicked off season two. And we look forward to you coming back for our next episode and another deep dive, this time on cybersecurity. As the most powerful nation in the world pours money into offense, private companies and taxpayers are mostly left to defend themselves. So I'll see you again right here on Peacock and on Sundays on Meet the Press. We'll be right back after a quick break. You're listening to a special edition of Meet the Press.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
I'm joined now by Jim Kavanaugh. He's a former special agent in charge at the ATF, where he worked for 32 years. He worked on the Unabomber case, Branch Davidian compound in Waco, Texas.
And for those of us in Washington, D.C., a memory we've never lost, the D.C. sniper case. You may also recognize Jim as one of the experts we talk to whenever there's a terror attack or an outbreak of violence, like the attack at the Capitol last week that killed one Capitol police officer and injured another. I want to talk to Jim for a longer conversation for a while now, and he's going to be part of our new season of Meet the Press Reports. We're kicking it off this week, Thursday night at 8 on NBC News Now and on demand on Peacock. And episode one is focusing on extremism, and Jim's a big part of it. And Jim, I guess that's where I want to start, which is, first of all, how did you end up on cases like the Unabomber, Branch Davidian? How did you end up in that wing of law enforcement?
Well, you know, I was a uniformed officer in Florida when I was young. My degree was criminology. I was a patrol cop on the beat, and I took the test for the feds.
Where were you in Florida, by the way?
I was in Pasco County, which is the first county north of Tampa.
Yeah.
And it was 1974 when I went on the job. Actually, my first day, I completed the academy. Was supposed to report for a shift at 4 p.m. and had to ride for a month with a partner. And I was on my front porch of my house when the radio cars came screaming right up to my house, turned in the street right next to my house. I was on a corner and pulled up in front of the house behind me. This was probably at 2 p.m. And I hadn't even just put my uniform on because I was going to be my first day of patrol. And then more cars and unmarked cars and a helicopter. I thought, man, I don't know what's going on back there. And there was a house, and I ran back over there and showed some of the deputies my badge. And I said, what's going on? I said, the guy's got his girlfriend hostage in there.
Jesus.
And to make a long story short, you know, it was resolved by all the deputies tackling the guy, getting him near the front door and tackling him, saving the woman. And I said, gosh, I haven't even got my uniform on yet. And then when I got in the car with the other deputy, first call we got was a stabbing, and we raced to that. There's a man standing in the middle of the street with his belly sliced like a fish from right across his waist, bleeding all over himself. And then we went in a bar there and arrested the assailant. And that was all before 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock on my first day.
My God.
I was in a shootout there, and when I was an officer, a guy went and shot five people.
This is all Pasco County, and folks, I mean, look, Pasco's not at all like rural or the sticks, but it's also not Miami or Orlando or Tampa.
Yeah, it's true. But, I've come to learn in all my years, 36 years, that I knew officers who were cops in small towns who had been in five shootouts, and I knew cops who had been big city cops who really never drew their gun. So sometimes it's just the beat. Sometimes it's just the culture of the area, the poverty. We had in Pasco a lot of really poor areas, and we had, kind of retirement communities on the coast. So we had the whole gamut. But anyway, then I went to ATF, and of course, ATF was like that too. I mean, bombings, guns, that's what we did.
Right.
The old liquor days were Elliot Ness and many years ago. So we did. Well,
your experience really comes right at the start of when law enforcement work went analytical, right? Where it was more than just, you're a cop on the street, right? The leaps and bounds we made in law enforcement investigative tactics all really began, it sounds like, when you sort of came of age in this.
No, that's exactly true. I mean, we had a Motorola radio, didn't even have a walkie talkie. We'd lay the microphone over the door, the car door on top of the badge. In case we got in trouble on the call, we could run out and grab the microphone and get help. We didn't even have a walkie talkie. The walkie talkies that a few guys had were a giant military thing. So, yeah, we saw lots of developments. And, of course, in the federal service, the training was just exemplary training, unbelievable, great training. And they had the funds to keep us equipped. And they had the work ethics and the policies that made it a great place to work. And, of course, right there in the 70s, one of the biggest things that we were doing in ATF was going after all the violent offenders. And a lot of those violent offenders were Klansmen. Mm-hmm. This was the pre-militia days, but they were the Ku Klux Klan, and they would be stockpiling machine guns and hand grenades because they always wanted to hurt somebody, and dynamite. And so we were always making cases on them. We had agents join their claverns, disrupt them. We'd arrest their individual members. Mm-hmm. Many, many, many cases over the years, we worked against the Klan. Of course, later we worked heavily against the militias doing the same things and all the bombings. You know, I was.
How would you differentiate the Klan and the militias? Or the militias really just evolved Klansmen? I
know yeah, it's so much crossover, Chuck, yeah. And so much bleed over and interconnection. The Klan starts out really as real hardcore racists to the core. The militia members start out as more as anti-government. Some of them try to stay on one side of that line mm-hmm. publicly and are not privately, and others do try to stay on one side, but they're still extremists. I mean, they hate the government, want to overthrow it, you know, like we've seen in the insurrectionists. I call them false patriots. But there's a little separation in that mindset, you know, where the neo-Nazis and Klan are really, really the hardcore. And, you know, we busted up plots where we have an informant in the claver and they're going to bomb the Jewish temple, Nazis and Klansmen. And they would, you know, these were the Nazis, George Lincoln Rockwell style, that wore the uniform with the swastika. And we'd bust their plots up, arrest them, serve search warrants on them. You know, ATF's been taken out of that fight now almost because of everything's gone to FBI. And it's really a shame. We had 40 years of fighting that. And, you know.
Yeah, I tell you, you and I could do a whole half hour about sort of what's happened, what, you know, how ATF was sort of became a political football and arguably, you know, I feel like ATF didn't recover from the NRA fights.
Now, I think that's true. I mean, we still don't have a permanent director at ATF. We've had only one in three of the last 15 years. So
I know it's not a new headquarter building anymore, but I will say this, my appreciation for ATF never was low, but it goes up exponentially when you spend a little bit of time at the headquarters down there. It's an impressive, it's an impressive compound, and it's a reminder. I mean, you know, I grew up in Miami and I remember, and I did, it's sort of, you know, one of the most, I guess, gruesome days in ATF history took place in Miami. So,
right. I mean, in the early 80s, on the Vice President's South Florida Task Force, we sent agents from all over the United States to fight the drug cartels down there, the influx of cocaine down here in Miami. And we had two agents killed about 1981. Yeah. The headquarters is named after one of them. And, you know, one was trying to buy guns and dope and got in a big shootout, shot. Our other agents killed one, and then not long after that, we had an agent trying to buy silencers from dope dealers, and he got killed. So that was in the early 80s. But, you know, there was a point, it may still be true, that ATF had more agents killed in the line of duty than any other federal agency, and most of that was during the liquor days, Prohibition. Right. Their names are on the wall at the police memorial. But you have to put that in context. We only are a small force, ATF. I mean, it has 5,000 employees and 2,500 special agents that, you know, make arrests. And, you know, the FBI has 13,000 special agents and 33,000 employees. They're much bigger, but they only had, say, half the agents killed in the line of duty. Now, most of that is historic. And the FBI just had two agents killed recently in Miami. So, those jobs can be violent, but we do get a chance sometimes to plan, so it's not. We try to.
Let's talk about the topic that we're focused on here in extremism. And you know, it's interesting. I have one memory of the Klan and extremism of the 70s and 80s. And, you know, the Klan always was wanting to do big marches, and the one in Illinois turned into to one that became Skokie incident and stuff. Mm-hmm. But I'm curious – what of that extremism, you know, how direct line of today, and is there more extremism today, or do we just see it?
Well, it's a little bit of both of that, but I think really it's very resurgent. I mean, in the 70s and early 80s, working on the Klan and the neo-Nazis, this was kind of the pre-militia days, you had a lot of public support and you had a lot of police support. The police weren't sympathizing with these guys. People say they were, but we would go and get help from detectives and deputies and police everywhere across the South. I mean, it wasn't, was a lot of help. Everybody was against them. I mean, I think the 60s violence, from the assassinations to the bombings and like 16th Street Church, and really put these guys on the edge of society where they really were. Mm-hmm. And no good citizen wanted to be associated with anything like that. There was no broad public support for them. Today, that's a big difference. They've become resurgent because people talk about the issues they want just like they did. I mean, they say the same things they did, but only they were saying it amongst their own, you know, crackpot crazies in their clavern meetings. Now we see that talk, you know, this anti-immigrant talk, and, you know, now we're trying to suppress the vote. We're trying to do all these things that, that these guys live for. And also, you know, I went back and I counted the names on the memorial to Southern Poverty Law Center. I would do the training, police training films for Southern Poverty Law Center about the Klan and the militia and any anti-government extremists in recent years. And we send that out to the police for roll call training. And I think there was 38 names of civil rights martyrs on that memorial. And then I went back and counted since 2009, I think it was. Since 2012, maybe. We had like 55 murders by hate groups across the country. You know,
since 2012.
So yeah, more than
doubling, more than what you're saying is more than doubling that wall.
Yeah, I mean, more than the civil rights era. And now we're back to voter suppression. We got these groups getting real strong. They're taking power from this insurrection. You know, so that's really interesting to me. I never thought we'd come full circle like that. I thought we'd really keep these guys marginalized, but they're not. They're so gaining energy.
How would you, if you were made the czar of, all right, we've got to combat this extremism, and there isn't one tactic. We know there's got to be multiple tactics. Some of it has to be societal decisions that are beyond sort of law enforcement. But how would you go about tackling this?
Well, you know, what I say is, I thought it was a sea change is when we pressed everything into the Joint Terrorism Task Forces. I mean, we had a whole agency, 25,000 people, laboratories, technical people, 2,500 agents who would, you know, center on bombs and gun crime and violent crime. And we worked these guys off the edges of that. And really, that kind of came to a full stop. And we put, like, you know, one agent on every Joint Terrorism Task Force. And there's 66 of those or so. So you went from 2,500 to 66 people that were really working that as we worked it. And that all went to the FBI, so they would be, you know, could be in control of that. I mean, it's like having a war and the Army says to the Marine Corps, don't send all the Marine Corps over here in your divisions. Just send us a few privates and you'll be included fighting a war with us. Well, the Marines don't fight like that. They send their whole structure. They send the Marine Division, then they go up through the flank in Iraq. They fight with all their commanders. They fight with all their tools.
So it sounds like you think the FBI, unfortunately, is taking what they did for international terrorism and trying to fit a square peg into a round hole?
Yeah, I mean, they did. It gives them control. I mean, I don't blame them as an agency. They want control. But why can't two agencies in the same department do better on that? You know, we hear so much talk about the intelligence analyst, Johnson, who is a great guy. He was over at Homeland Security, and they smacked him down when he, you know, wrote an intelligence brief about the neo-Nazis in the military. Well, he worked for ATF for years. He was an ARD analyst in ATF. And he left and went to Homeland Security. And, you know, people talk that they dismantled that three-person intelligence unit, and they shouldn't have done it. I agree. And I think it should be built up. I agree. But that pales in comparison to taking the 2,500 special agents and ATF out of it. That's never mentioned. And it's long forgotten.
And I assume the best way you got to some of these groups we're finding them breaking other laws.
Oh, right? Hey, listen, that
I mean,
was
this is the way to get them, right?
This is, I mean, this was our stock in trade. I mean, we would find out they had machine guns or hand grenades. We'd infiltrate them, undercover them, use informants. And you know, when ATF was moved from the Treasury to Justice in 2002, the law that moved us says, the last line in that law says, the Attorney General should consider giving ATF more responsibilities in domestic terrorism. So it's not even a statute requirement. I mean, it's not a training requirement. It's not a money requirement. It's nothing. It's the Attorney General saying ATF will be involved in this fight like they were for 40 years, and they're going to coordinate with the FBI, and they're going to share. And, you know, people talk about sharing. The only reason people don't share is because they're afraid the other person's going to take it away. So there's no problem to share stuff if the other person's not taking it away. Yeah. Once you work as colleagues, like the Pentagon's a great model, the Joint Chiefs, mm-hmm. you know, they work together. And that's the way these units, I say it this way too, Chuck. In international terrorism, we have the CIA, we have the DIA, we have the military intelligence units of all the services. We have Special Operations Command. We have State Department special agents. We have NSA that listens to, you know, satellite recordings. We have all these agencies.
You've got the National Counterterrorism Center. There's right. also that.
But from the federal service, we only have the FBI. So I think we should, I'm just talking about injustice. They should throw ATF deeper in that fight. Well, will they do it? I don't know. But that's what, if they were asking me, I would do. I would make them coordinate with FBI, make FBI coordinate with them. And that's how you get a team together instead of, you know, just having it in one place. So, and the FBI get, you know, they get dumped on. I mean, everything that comes up, you know, give it to them, give it to them, you know, give it to Mikey, see if he likes it, you know, mm-hmm. just dump it on them. Well, I mean, you dump so much stuff on an agency. How are they ever going to deal with it? And then, you know, what the agency comes in and says, well, we got to have more people. Well, okay, well, we already got people. We already got the people over here. And you know what they're doing? They're today they're all over the United States buying guns, serving warrants, arresting people, investigating bombings, doing all the things you want to do. They're doing it right now and been doing it since, you know, 40 years. So anyway, that's just one issue. But
thanks for listening to a special edition of Meet the Press. We'll be right back after a quick break.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
There was one of the things you brought up just now, and I was curious where you think the military, which is this issue of sort of the you know, some neo-Nazis getting military training, right? Becoming members of our military, getting this military training.
Right.
Is it our vetting process? What should we be doing when they are enlisted? Are we doing, or is this just always going to happen? You're going to have some.
Well, we can't let it always happen. I mean, it has been happening, you know, people with swastika tattoos or, you know, had been members of hate groups, the Klan, should never, ever be allowed in the military or the police service. I mean, that should never, ever happen. And if they're in, they should be kicked out. I mean, people that believe that are anti-American. They're right. anti-government. They're going to turn on the military. They're going to turn on the police. And they're going to turn on our citizens. So that everybody, every law enforcement agency should have a vetting process for that. That even lightweight to do it. If they're involved in those groups, you know, they're not a member of the people that are going to have force and power over our citizens or, you know, our military.
Yeah, and how do we improve that? You know, it's interesting that your background is Florida. And I grew up with guys that were desperate to be highway patrolmen, right? And everybody right. wanted in that sort of, I don't know whether you called it yellow or beige and black. I don't, you know, those
yeah.
state trooper. Very, very iconic for those of us, those Floridians. But it was always interesting to me. You'd find people that failed the highway patrol test, but was able to pass you know, maybe failed Miami Dade County's metro test, but passed another one. How do you feel about that? Is there, and nobody wants to, you know, how federalized should this become?
Yeah, I don't.
Heading up police.
I don't think, I love the FHP. Been in a lot of fights with FHP, you know, with them and me on the same side. They're great. And, but, you know, what you got to understand in that, in state police units, the physical training is very demanding usually. Mm-hmm. Very, very physical demands on state police units. That's been.
So that doesn't bother you. You're saying somebody failing that. You're not sitting there saying that should disqualify him as
a No, okay. it's not going to happen. Everybody can't work for a TV network. They work at a local affiliate. It does, sure. It's not makes them better or worse. And if they don't pass that, if they're not passing for a reason that's, you know, like we're talking about a hate group or they're a thief or something, then, you know, it maybe just they didn't make the physical or something. They can go to work for another department and have a great career. Listen, you know, I love cops. That's the model where the cop is right out of central casting. You know, the cop looks like, you know, Randolph Scott. He's got the hat cocked perfect. He looks great. And sometimes those guys aren't the best cops. Right. You know, I always loved the cops that were kind of disheveled. And, you know, I don't know. It's not exactly Columbo, but, you know, I knew a cop. I won't tell his name, but he went on to be a chief of police. I knew him when he was a young cop, and he was the best policeman you would ever see. He was fair. He arrested people. He could dig into stuff. He was a nice guy, and he looked the worst in his uniform. He looked the absolute worst. I mean, if you saw him, you would like, is this guy really the police? I mean, he looked so awful, but he was a great cop. So, you know, it's sometimes not the cover. You know, he would never have made it in the state police. And he was the city police. He would never have made it in the state police because he wouldn't ever wear that uniform so sharp. And that's not to say the guys that don't wear it sharp are also great cops. It's true that that can happen both ways. But I'm saying I always liked people that were, you know, had this battle scars of leadership, the battle scars of policing. They knew, you know, just as a quick note, I always laugh about this because, of course, my name is Kavanaugh, but. You know, we all remember the series Kojak.
Yeah.
And that was...
Well, you and I do. We can't say we all remember him, Jim.
Well, some of us...
I was just going to say, I do. I remember Telly Savalas and the lollipop, but I guarantee you, I'm not sure my producer, Matt Rivera, if I said Telly Savalas, he'd immediately...
Well,
Matt
can look up Kojak. But anyway, his line was, who loves you, baby? But anyway, that TV show was totally predicated... on an NYPD detective named Paul Kavanaugh, whose nickname was the Velvet Tongue. Hmm. And what he did was he got confessions from people because he treated people with respect and he knew how to talk to people. And he was really a great detective. His claim to fame was, though, a guy was sent up to Sing Sing on a murder. And Kavanaugh looked the case over and said, this guy didn't do this murder. And he went and dug out an old photograph in the case, and he went and proved that the guy could not have been present at the murder scene, which had happened a few years earlier. And he got him released. He got him out. This was before there was any Innocence Project.
Right, or DNA.
He got him out of prison. Right. Yeah. And, of course, he later, like all old cops, he moved to Florida, retired, and he's since passed away. But that whole series of Kojak was predicated on Paul Kavanaugh, an NYPD detective, who was one of these guys I'm talking about. Now, he was a sharp dresser, you know, an NYPD detective, but he had the skills of interview and interrogation. I love cops like that, you know, that can come at it softly, you know.
I'm curious, where do you think we're going with policing and as you've been watching the Chauvin trial, where do you think we're headed? Is this going to be you have the chief of police testifying against him. Is this turn a page on the relationship between sort of the law and the police?
I'm hopeful it will. You know, I love cops. I mean, I've been a cop all my life, but I don't like corrupt cops. I don't like racist cops. And I don't like, bully cops. And I always say, you know, cops can smell a murder out a mile away, except when a cop does it. I mean, I was on MSNBC the day they released the video of the young man killed in Chicago on the double yellow line,
right,
call it with a knife. I mean, once you see the video, you know, the anchor said, "What do you think?" I said, "It's cold-blooded murder." "What do you mean? What do I think?" "It's not even a think here. You shot him 13 times while he's laying on a double yellow line. He had a knife. It's cold-blooded murder." So why do we have to? Sometimes these things are so clear-cut, you know, it's there's no debate, and the police have to call it out, and the commanders need to call it out. And what I say, they, in a case like that, let's hey, call internal affairs up, look the video, look the witness. Hey, did he do it? Yeah, go get a warrant. I'll sign it. I'm the chief. I'm signing the warrant on the guy for murder. Get his gun and badge. He's going to be booked today. And instead of, now, I'm not talking, that's not a split-second decision case that it's arguable or even arguable. And that's like the Chauvin case. I mean, 9 minutes, it's just he's murdering the guy. And it's all on videotape. And I do think he'll be convicted, by the way. And he should be. But, yeah, I'm hopeful there's going to be a change. I'm hopefully cities are going to give the officers the tools to make the changes. It costs money.
Yep.
And
you think we're asking cops to do too much?
Yeah, sure. We always are asking cops to do too much. Yeah. I mean, that's just the nature of the job. But if now it's people realize they're asking that, maybe they can pare back on the mental health issues and, you know, ramp up.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, it's funny, and we'll close with this when we're talking about extremism. One person's extremist is another person's victim of a mental health crisis. And, I think I'm not trying to be dismissive of it. I mean, there, to me, there's a fine line between these people that become leaders of these militias. I mean, you know, David Koresh went crazy. Ted Kaczynski went crazy. Now he also, they also got people killed.
Yeah.
You know, so they both had mental health problems, but that didn't make them any less of a murderer.
Well, you know, I talked to Koresh that first day in the shootout for maybe 18 hours. I talked to him all week. I was a negotiator and a commander at the time. And, you know, he's trying to sell. He's the Lamb of God, the seven seals and all that. And he's trying to sell that to us. And the thing is, you know, 99% of them wanted to believe that, but 1% of them deep down inside knew he was just Vernon Wayne Howell, a two-bit crook who took over that.
Right? He knew he was a grifter, you feel like?
Yeah, yeah, he knew. You know, when he moved the families in there, he never slept with, you never slept with your wife again once you moved in with your family. And he slept with your young daughters, your 12-year-old and up daughters, and he gave them a David pin. And you just worked in the field if you were a man. Yeah, he knew what he was and what he was doing. And that's why we couldn't get him to come out, because he wasn't going to leave that. He was in there with everybody thinking he's God and unlimited sex, and they're all worshiping him, and he's going to go in a cold cell. That's why he wouldn't come out. And he took that Branch Davidian Church over in a gun battle years before he had the gun battle with ATF. He took it over with a gun battle, and people often forget that. Of course, that was the early days when we started to see the support in Congress for this crackpotism and this ultra-right-wing craziness supporting and propping up the lies of the Branch Davidians and this murder. The judges and the judiciary system did not. They stuck with the facts and the truth. But some members of Congress, they went the other way.
Well, and now it looks like it's even worse.
Oh, it's awful now. I mean, it's just so awful. I think the most important thing for all of us as Americans is the truth. Stick with the truth. The big lie is always trying to destroy us with this voter lie and voter suppression. Voter suppression is so important. The extremists and insurrections are going to get stronger. We need to work on them. We need to, when they're involved in violence, they need to get long terms. And I think the FBI case against the insurrectionists is significant, because many of these guys, although they're extremists and they talk big and they get a bunch of guns, they don't do good time in prisons. They're not really career criminals. They're not like La Cosa Nostra, who can go in and out of the prison system 5 and 6 times just because it's their life. They're not like that. And so, you know, it really puts a damper on them. It puts a scare in them. And I'll give you one example. They all, these guys that were the insurrectionists, had lots and lots of guns. They all have lots and lots of guns. Very few of them showed up in the District of Columbia on January 6th with their guns because they did not want to be arrested for having the guns there illegally. Yeah. Now, that's when a gun law works, because if they'd all showed up with their AR-15s and bandoleros strapped on them, that thing could have been a whole lot worse. So the gun laws worked for us that day.
Jim Kavanaugh, it was good to have a half hour with you. I appreciate all your expertise, your straight talk, and you've been somebody that sees that you see firsthand what happens when lies.
Well, Chuck, it's great to talk to you as always, and on MTP and MTP Daily. Right, and you have a lot of fans, and I'm one. I have one fan. It's my 3-year-old grandson, and he is not sure between me and Big Bird which he likes the best.
It's all right. He sees them both on television. So that's right. Jim is great, man. Thank you, sir.
All right, see.
Appreciate it. You've been listening to the Chuck Toddcast from Meet the Press. Today's episode was produced by Justice Green and Matt Rivera. John Reese is our executive producer. And our theme music composed by Spoke Media. You can catch Meet the Press daily on MSNBC every day at 1. Meet the Press Reports is back. Check it out Thursday night, 8 p.m., 11 p.m. Eastern, or on demand anytime on Peacock. Or The Big Show every Sunday morning. So thanks for listening, and until we upload again.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.